Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to introduce Desiree Mays. She's the author of Opera Unveiled, the book now in its 12th year that comes out every year to accompany the five operas of the Santa Fe opera season. Desiree lectures nightly at the Preview Buffet of the Santa Fe Opera. She's an international lecturer and spends much of the winter season lecturing at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And she's tour director of Act One Tours, which takes people all over the world to see opera. The Santa Fe Opera season this year opens on Friday, July 2nd. Welcome, Desiree, to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Today we're going to talk about the opera Life is a Dream, and that is a world premiere, which, of course, none of us has actually seen it yet, but we're going to talk about it in a moment. But before we do that, I want to talk about a couple of things that are happening. First of all, Desiree Mays, you're going to be reading today, this afternoon, this evening at Collected Works Bookstore.
That's right. I'm going to read the original story of Madame Butterfly by John Luther Long. This came from a novella that was written in Philadelphia in 1898, and that's open to everyone. So please come at 6 o'clock to Collected Works, downtown Santa Fe, and hear about the original Madame Butterfly.
And then there's going to be another event in a couple of days at the Vista Grande Library.
Yes, that's out in El Dorado where I live. I do this every year, and it's an overview of the season. If anyone would like to come to that, we'll just talk for about an hour. It's at 7 o'clock.
On Thursday
the 24th, an overview of the season in connection with my book, of course, Opera Unveiled.
And there are also a couple of things that the opera would like everybody to know about. One is the fact that there's backstage tours.
Yes, the backstage tours are something very popular. They're also nice and early in the morning, so it's not too hot. You can go up to the opera, and the backstage tours are every Monday through Saturday, starting May 31st through the season. They're for a very, very nominal amount of money, tiny. And they go from the box office at 9 a.m. in the morning. You just have to show up. That is riveting. It gives you real insights to the backstage costume sets, and you can or cannot get on the stage, depending on what is in production at the time. But it gives wonderful insights. That's always when I take people abroad to opera houses, that's always a high point, to be able to go backstage to some of these great theaters and see what goes on.
And finally, there's something called Opera Insiders.
Yes, Opera Insiders is something that's been very popular. And for 13 Saturdays, starting June 5th through every Saturday, the Opera Guild invites people to come to the theater at 8:30 in the morning, and you'll be given coffee and muffins. And then at 9 o'clock, an opera production staff member will talk about his or her specialty, and that includes a backstage tour as well. That's something really worthwhile doing. On June 5th, for instance, Randy Lutz is the prop director. He will speak, and then David Burke in costumes, Eric Moore, the tech director. So there's a number of different people, and you can go to santafeopera.org, I think, to find out which department chief will be speaking each week. So that's at 8:30 on Saturday mornings. Just go up to the opera, coffee, muffins, hear a talk, and then see the backstage tour.
Okay, so let's start talking about this world premiere opera, Life is a Dream. Now, this is by composer Lewis Spratlin and librettist James Moranis, but it's based on a 17th century story.
Exactly, yeah, from Calderon, from the great time of Spanish literature, the golden age of Spanish theater.
Pedro Calderón.
That's right.
De la Barca.
De la Barca Calderón. He was a great playwright. He wrote a series of what were called honor plays. Most of them had religious themes, and this one does too. It's about the conflict between fate and free will. It's about the struggle between father and son. And it's a simple little story, but it sort of flips out into illusion and dreams and what is real and what isn't, all the big questions. It's a metaphysical opera in a sense, which shouldn't put people off, because the story is very easy. It's an easy story as it seems, but it's what's going on under the surface that's important and what is being taught. Now, what they were teaching in the 1600s, of course, doesn't necessarily appeal to what's going on here, though actually the theme of honor is just as relevant today, and fathers and sons still battle it out, as is seen in many, many operas. So the work is pretty timeless and universal. When Lewis Spratlin saw the play, read it, he was instantly bowled over. He says, "This is written for music." Calderon was sort of the Shakespeare of Spain at the time. They were sort of contemporaries. His poetry in the play is quite lovely. And they virtually took most of the great soliloquies and lifted them wholesale from the play into the opera. It had to be cut down dramatically, of course, as all operas do. I mean, it turns out someone did the math that for three lines of prose, it's one line of music. Mm-hmm. So that means it's going to be cut by two-thirds, right? You're left with a third. The story has to get into that. The reason for that is that music takes a little longer to express feeling, to give you time to get into it, to describe it, and it's much more thorough and much better than words. I mean, you know that. Sometimes music will say what words can't, and opera's all about that.
Well, and something that opera-goers can really look for is how does the music itself express the action that we're looking at on stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in a contemporary sense. And this is done with the 12-tone scale. We talked with Madame Butterfly about the pentatonic scale of five notes. This is 12-tone, which is contemporary modern music, if you like, started with Schoenberg, Webern, and is not always seen as easy. It's a much more structured form in a sense. But within that form, this is what Lewis Spratlin is writing in. The story of how the opera came into being is sort of intriguing. Shall we talk a little about that? It turns out that Lewis Spratlin had been invited by the New Haven Opera Company in the 70s to write an opera. So he wrote this opera. He wrote Life is a Dream, and then he had the whole thing written. It was even orchestrated. Typically, a composer will write a piano score and then go back and orchestrate it. This particular composer likes to do the whole thing all at once, which is sort of unique.
He wrote the libretto also?
No. He in the score with the music. Okay. He fully orchestrated the piece.
So he didn't have. So that's very interesting. I think it's important. The composer will write the whole opera without even having the words yet.
Oh no. Let me backtrack a little. Okay. When he saw the play, he was discussing it with his neighbor, literally in the next house. They were both professors at Amherst at the time, James Moranis, who was a professor of Spanish and an authority on Calderon, as it turned out. So the two men are, you know, chatting over a beer about the possibility of this opera, and Lewis Spratlin said it became very clear to him that the librettist had to be James Moranis. Mm-hmm. So that's how it started. And between the two of them then, of course, were invited to write for the New Haven Opera. They wrote the play, the opera libretto was written, the score was completed, and then the opera company collapsed. It just fell apart. And they were devastated. They were left with this fully completed opera on their hands and nowhere to perform it. So they sent it out for years to different opera companies to try and get it picked up, and nobody did. And then Lewis Spratlin did something that apparently composers do. He submitted it in the year just before 2000 to the Pulitzer Prize Committee. And lo and behold, it won the prize for music in the year 2000.
Having never been performed.
First of all, two things. First of all, it had never been performed, and they only had the second act. This is a three-act opera, and they only had the second act. And it was very clear in the citation, apparently. The award was given for the music of the second act. So that was an amazing boost. And Lewis Spratlin said, I've talked to him through all of this. It's been intriguing. He said he just sat back and waited for the phone to ring, you know, expecting for operas to come in, you know, contracts right left, and nothing happened.
Oh, my goodness.
Nothing. Until then the Santa Fe Opera picked it up, and they were interested and talked with Schirmer, who are the music publishers who now own the piece, and started collaborating. And he said when he was asked for the makeup of the orchestra, what musicians did I need, he knew that perhaps they were going to be serious. So both men are ecstatic about finally, 30 years near enough, from the time this work was first conceived to giving, that's a long gestation, to giving birth. For me, it's always a challenge, Mary Shard, with a brand new opera, because I've never never seen it and not heard it, and I have to write about it in my book. So I was very fortunate. I was able to talk with Lewis Spratlin, and he was so generous. Both of them were. I would email back and forth and ask questions, and he answered in great depth, and all of that went into my book. So in Opera Unveiled, the chapter about life is a dream is pretty much word for word what Lewis Spratlin said and approved, because I sent everything back for him for an okay at the end. But that's how it came into being. And he then will be here for the premiere. They both will be here through the weeks of rehearsal into the performances. So that's how it came about. Now, what is it about? And that's let me tell you very quickly the story.
Yeah.
We'll play a little music, clearly only from the second act.
Right.
It starts out in a sort of a wild wilderness place, and this is the opera I call surreal. And we'll talk about that. It's surreal in terms of its production. We'll get to that a little later, perhaps. It's a wild place. There's a tower, and inside the tower is a young man who is chained. He's a prisoner. His name is Sigismundo. And he's watched over by a cruel jailer called Clotaldo. As the opera opens, two people arrive out of the storm. Rosaura, who happens to be a woman but is dressed as a man, as opera tends to do this, and her servant, who's sort of a clown. And they come across this tower, and they find Sigismundo, who would come tearing out at them if he could. And Rosaura is a little sorry for him. She doesn't understand what's going on. Clotaldo comes in, and he says, "Because you are here, because you have seen this man in this tower, you will be condemned to death. I have to take you to the king." So before that happens, Rosaura, hands Clotaldo the sword that she has. And the sword was a sword that was left to her by her father. She doesn't know who he is, and she's come to avenge a wrong done to her. Clotaldo looks at the sword and realizes that this is his son or daughter. So, you know, that's a bit confusing at the beginning.
Yeah, I was going to say, so wait a minute. Let's just to recap.
Rosaura,
or Rosauro, is the daughter of this guy who is imprisoning
the daughter of the seeming jailer, who's actually a minister of the king.
Right, but he is... He has been made to watch this jailed, chained person named Sigismundo. And do we know why he is imprisoned?
At this point, we don't. That's the opening scene. And then the next scene is at the palace, and Clotaldo, the man who's watching over the prisoner, who is actually a minister of the king, talks with the king, Basilio. And we hear the story. The story is that Basilio, when this child was born, Sigismundo is his son. And when the child was born, it was a terrible birth. The mother was torn apart. There was an eclipse of the sun. All the portents foretold that this boy, this young man, if he grew to be a man, would be evil. He would destroy his father. And because Basilio, as in those days, they believed in the stars and what they foretold, he decided that after the mother died in childbirth, that this child would be taken away, locked up in a tower, and no one was to ever see him on pain of death.
So it's like a Greek tragedy.
It is a Greek tragedy. It comes from the same sort of genre. So yeah. Here he is. He's locked away. But Basilio, at this point, at the beginning of the second act, is beginning to have second thoughts, thinking, have I done the right thing? I mean, he's banished this child, his own flesh and blood, hasn't seen him, locked him up in primitive conditions. He is a beast. And he says, I'm going to give him a chance. I'm going to have him come to the palace for one day, and he will be a prince in his rightful place, and we'll see how he behaves. If he behaves properly, then he can take up his rightful place. If he doesn't, he'll be banished back to his tower. And the way that they plan to do this is by drugging him. He's going to be drugged so that he falls asleep in his tower and wakes up in the palace. And then they'll see how he behaves. If he misbehaves, they'll drug him again and take him back. Now, this is exactly what happens.
This is a great opera thing. Okay, you have a child under a total eclipse. You decide he's going to, through astrology, he's going to be no good. So you banish him for until he's a man. Mm-hmm. And then you think, gosh, maybe he'll be nice and bring him back.
Yeah,
how could somebody be nice when he's been in chains for 20 years?
Well, he wants to give him a chance and clear his own conscience, perhaps. It's one of those, you know, classic father-son battles that goes on. So he brings him to the palace, and Clotaldo is there. He's let in on this plan about the drugs, and the prince wakes up and finds himself surrounded by all this magnificence. He's dressed in royal clothes, and he begins to take to this. But then in the course of things, he doesn't know how to behave. He is very rude to everyone who comes near him, and one servant keeps trying to tip him off as to how to behave, and he gets so angry with the servant that he picks him up and throws him over the edge of the palace to his death on the rocks below. And everyone is appalled. Rosaura comes in. She's now dressed as a woman. That's another whole story. And he sees her, and she thinks she's the most beautiful thing he's ever seen, and he attempts to rape her until all the courtiers pull out. So he's acting as a beast. At that point, the father comes in, and he says to him, let me read you the word. This English opera is in English, of course, and I'm going to play you this little section. Basilio, the king, comes in and says, "It grieves me, prince, that your first act of freedom, which I hoped would show forewarned discretion, should instead be grave homicide. Can I embrace you knowing that your arms are schooled in murder? Who can regard without some fear the naked blade that has been used to give a mortal wound? Who can feel nothing when he feels the bloody place where a man has been killed?" And Sigismundo angrily reacts, "I have lived till now without you. Do you think I should miss the kind embrace of a father who has taken me from his side to have me raised as a beast, and then, as if I were a monster, sought my death? You have deprived me of my humanness. What do I care that you keep me now from your arms?" So let's listen to that little piece from the second act of Life is a Dream. So that's a little of Sigismundo's first confrontation with his father, the king Basilio. So he behaves so badly that they decide they're going to send him back to his tower. And Rosaura, if you can call her a love interest, there is an attraction between the two, and maybe an empathy is a better word. She sings a little aria of her own that was not in the original Calderon. This was written in by Maranas. And she sings "The Victim of His Life Itself, with too much life within to die, with too much pain within to live, so hard to bear, so hard to know the truth, or what it is to love."
The victim of his life itself.
So that's a brief aria, as they are. If you can call it an aria, with contemporary music, there's really not arias and, stopping and starting. The whole thing, most operas now are through composed.
Yeah, we talked about that last year with The Letter, which had a kind of cinematic quality. It wasn't aria and recitative. It just went all the way through. This one's like that as well?
Somewhat. It's certainly not cinematic. This is a piece that literally goes in and out of the real, the unreal. When are we dreaming and when are we awake? You know, whatever you and I did yesterday was real enough at the time, but today, looking back, it has a dreamlike quality.
Right.
Especially the wonderful things that happen to us in life, most the extremes, the great wonders and the great horrors that happen, when you look back on them, they hardly seem real.
Well, they become narratives.
That's right. So that's part of what we're looking at here. So
now, the music we just heard, 12-tone music, mm-hmm. is that a special challenge for opera singers?
Yes, this is a very difficult score. And when Lewis Bratlin came to composing it, he wondered where to begin. And he was actually given the very first line of the play by James Moranis, the librettist, in Spanish. And that seemed to just turn on his creative powers, and he wrote that theme. Each of the characters has their own 12-tone sequence, but it all comes from Sigismundo. His was the first one that was developed, and each time, is the more you get to hear this, the more you begin to pick that up. His is the first one, then the others are composed around that, each describing their different personalities. For instance, Clarin, who is this clownish servant of hers, comes from Clarin the trumpet. He's depicted by a trumpet, and it's a lighter-hearted music. Rosara's music is more circular. Sigismundo's is very angry as it goes through the piece. And I really encourage people with a new opera, it's impossible to judge it at the first time hearing.
Yeah.
Because you really don't know what you're hearing. You have to hear it a few times in order, especially contemporary music. And this particular piece for the singer Roger Honeywell is so challenging for Sigismundo. I saw him, heard him sing the second act last summer in a workshop situation, and it really was a killer. But it was wonderful seeing the interaction then between composer, librettist, and singers as they struggled with words and musical aspects, and there's a really collaborative process going on here. Opera is increasingly more and more collaborative at all levels, and that's so exciting because typically you could totally exclude the composer and the librettist from the set, and the director and the conductor get on with it. But that never happens here. Santa Fe works so wonderfully with its visiting composers and librettists. This happened last year with The Letter.
Yeah.
It'll happen again this year. So that's been interesting. One of the singers, John Cheek, who sings King Basilio, actually sang this piece years ago. He was the very first Basilio through all of its many trials and tribulations. He will be here to sing Basilio, and as I said, Roger Honeywell sings Sigismundo. Clotaldo is a very important role sung by James Maddalena, who was in The Letter last year. Rosara is Ellie Dane, a soprano who's having a wonderful international career at the moment. And the conductor is interesting, too. This is a familiar name, I think, to most people. The conductor is Leonard Slatkin.
Yeah.
So it
very
turns,
famous conductor.
Very famous conductor. It turns out that he has been a champion of contemporary opera for many years, and he has been really thrilled, apparently, to be part of this collaborative team bringing this piece to life. The director is Kevin Newbery. He did our Falstaff here, and I was able to talk to him as well, and I said, what are you doing with this? And he said, well, this opera is going to have steampunk. I said, what's steampunk? I mean, that's a new word in my vocabulary. So this is what he said. He said, we were drawn to images of steampunk, a genre of science fiction that features beautifully complicated machines and fictional technological gadgets. Our world has a mechanized feel to it, while its characters are enslaved by curses and superstitions. So you can see the juxtaposition here. In fact, I can give you an example. At the beginning, there's this little miniature gold throne that's sitting on top of a submarine turret, which is crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, that represents the king's throne sitting on top of his son, who is imprisoned in this tower. So that's steampunk. And another point, there are great blocks of wood stretched across the stage with their innards that look like clockwork. This is a forest. It's quite magical. The whole thing is black, black floors, black walls, to suggest a timelessness to the piece. So I think this is one reason to go see this opera. It is surreal. And I think given the story and all that it implies, it's going to be very exciting to see how this is done. So that was Kevin Newbery. That's his idea. Though to offset these surreal sets are absolutely gorgeous 16th century inspired costumes that could have come out of a Shakespeare play. So again, you have a contrast here. It's all about contrast, about dreaming and sleeping, awake, illusion, real, fate, free will, and predestination. All of these big issues are written into this piece, and it's on some level it's quite an intellectual challenge, I suppose, to deal with. But the story is simple enough. He ends up, Sigismundo ends up taking his rightful place. He gets into
as the prince,
he gets into a battle with his father. He wins the battle, and the father comes to him fully expecting to be killed. But he's made the transition. He has now become a prince, making wise decisions, and he's left the wildness behind. And even that raises a question. Is he now an automaton, just playing by the rules? He gives up Rosaura and marries Estrella because it's a politically correct thing to do. It raises a lot of questions. The ending in the play is where in the opera originally, and the play, was where he everything gets resolved for now. But Lewis Bratlin talks a little bit about the music at the end of this opera, and I'm not going to give it away because I don't know if it's actually been fully decided yet how they will come out of this opera, how they will resolve the ending. It's not as pat as the prince now, you know, puts his bestial side behind him and moves forward. Nothing's that easy.
Well, as I understood from an interview that I was reading with Spratlin, there was this whole question of what do you do with an ending whose basic message is, and it's a 17th century kind of religious point of view, we must tame our bestial and sexual appetites because those are the root of all sin and
exactly.
evil. Well, we live in an era where really almost the opposite is what we think. If you repress your sexual appetites,
then
that's the root of all evil. And look at all these crazy politicians and so on. So what you do with that, and in this interview, he was saying, well, we didn't want to have a whole different ending, but a different interpretation of that ending. So I guess we'll just have to see.
You will have to go and see, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, at the Santa Fe Opera this summer, Life is a Dream, La Vida es Sueño.
We're talking about the opera Life is a Dream. Now, we've probably talked about it as much as we can because none of us has seen it yet. You've heard some of the music. We've played some of the music.
Exactly. So there's only one way to find out about the rest of it. I think the staging sounds wonderful, the costumes, the piece.
Steampunk.
And exactly. And Lewis Bratlin is a very highly honored composer and musician. So I think that's good. And I must say the Santa Fe Opera has to be congratulated for sticking its neck out, so to speak, and taking on new operas because they are risky. You never know quite how it's all going to work out. But I must say they do pick winners. Last year, The Letter was so great, and then Aina de Mar, The Life of Federico Garcia Lorca, A Mirror of Soul, a very meditative piece, so very different, very wonderful operas they've presented.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how all of these operas that you've mentioned go down in history. Are they going to be performed 50 years from now the way we're performing La Traviata today?
That's a good question. You know, are they only going to get one shot? That's really hard. That has happened here a number of times. An opera gets its premiere and is never heard of again. That is so hard. On the other hand, and this is happening increasingly now, I've just been to see Moby Dick. I mean, you never think that's going to be an opera, by Jake Heggie, which was magnificent in Houston. And the way that was approached was by five or six different opera companies worldwide pulled their resources together to produce this opera, because opera is a fantastically expensive event to take on. And for a number of companies to share in the production of one piece makes good sense. It also gives the piece a chance to see where its greatness is or is not. With Moby Dick, I think it will do very well for the composer and the librettist. Until you have that work up there on the stage in front of an audience, you're not really to know where the strengths and weaknesses lie. So this this becomes apparent, and with more airplay, literally with being seen, it'll happen. So Moby Dick will get plenty of airings, and the letter has been picked up in different places. A number of ours have, but it's a tragedy, I think, if a new opera is just played once and then disappears.
Now, there's an opera that premiered about 5 years ago by John Adams and Peter Sellers called Dr. Atomic, which is about Los Alamos and the Trinity test and all that. I'm surprised that hasn't been done here at the
opera. No, this would have been the natural place. I don't know what happened there. And I know that when Peter Sellers was here last with Ina Damar, he was running up and down all the time to Los Alamos and reading everything he could get his hands on about Robert Oppenheimer.
Right.
And then the opera happened, John Adams. We didn't get the premiere, but it's an amazing piece, and I must say it's my favorite aria of the entire 21st century, practically.
Really?
This aria I'm going to play for you, it's called Batter My Heart, and there's a wonderful background story to this. I love it for many reasons. The Batter My Heart is the opening words of a poem by John Donne, who is a metaphysical poem from the 1600s. The words are his, and it's about man begging God to make his presence felt. So he says, batter me, beat me, break me, anything you want to do with me so that I know you exist and that I can work for you. And this is totally appropriate, of course, for Oppenheimer at the time of the testing of the bombs out here. And this is the high point of the opera where they're about to test the bomb and he sings this aria. It turns out that Oppenheimer actually had this poem in his pocket at the time of the testing, which makes my hair stand on end. Oppenheimer was an incredibly educated man. He actually spoke Sanskrit. He understood the language. He was into this sort of poetry. And the singer who sings it, Gerald Finley, who became Oppenheimer in the premiere of this piece, is quite wonderful. So let's hear this aria, Batter My Heart, by John Adams from Dr. Atomic.
Batter my heart, free peasant God, for you as yet but not breathe, knock, breathe, shine and see. Batter my heart, free peasant God, that I may rise and stand, o'erthrow me and bend your force to break, like an usurped town, to another due, labor to admit you, but all to no end. Reason your viceroy in me should defend, but is captive.
There is a recording now out of this, and anything Gerald Finley sings is quite wonderful. He sang our troubadour prince in L'Amour de Loin by Kaya Sarriaho here a few years ago. He's been here a couple of times. I hope he'll come back.
We're talking to Desiree Mays. Now, one of the things that's interesting is we have every year a new crop of opera singers and the apprentices and although there is always worry about whether there will be opera audiences 20 years from now, 30 years from now, there's no worry about whether there will be opera singers because they're coming up and going through conservatories and being trained and so on, and we've got some wonderful ones. We usually do a show on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe with the apprentices. But it's interesting, too, because they're doing some crossover. They're singing not just opera, but musical theater and all kinds of things.
Yes, that's an interesting phenomenon that we're right in the middle of now, crossover, where an opera singer sings jazz. Patricia Rosette, actually, is probably the best example. She loves singing jazz, and she's a great soprano. Dawn Upshaw sings musicals. West Side Story, one of the great recordings, is with Kiri Tikhanova singing Maria.
Right.
So it's happening a lot, and I think it's sort of a time out. It's a relaxing time for singers that they love to do it. And this is great. I mean, it's another dimension. It's another way of hearing this music. I'd like to, as an example of this, to play you a track by a singer called Audrey McDonald. She was trained as a classical singer as Juilliard. They say of her God-given, unteachable abilities as an actress to speak and behave on stage with utter truth and spontaneity. I mean, what greater compliment can be paid to anyone? Utter truth and spontaneity. Terence McNally, the great playwright, said in his play Masterclass, she sang an aria in the play and it brought the house down and won her a Tony Award. So let's hear one track of hers. It's a little song called Daybreak in Alabama. The music's by Ricky Ian Gordon with a text by the great writer Langston Hughes, Daybreak in Alabama, and how she wants to be a composer and combine all cultures. Let's hear a little of that.
When I get to be a composer, I'm gonna write me some music about daybreak in Alabama, and I'm gonna put the prettiest songs in it, rising out of the ground like smoke mist and falling out of heaven like soft dew. I'm gonna put some tall trees.
Now, I'm sorry, that's an opera singer singing.
Yes, it
singing
is.
A musical. I mean, you can't, you know, there are people, I've met people, young opera, sort of up-and-coming opera singers. I met a young woman, she was in her early 20s. When she was singing jazz, she really sounded like a jazz singer, not like an opera singer singing jazz.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a big difference.
Yeah, there is a difference, exactly. Pat Rosette, I think, is hard to tell the difference when you see and hear her sing jazz. She's the real thing. Let's now move to the other side of the coin, where you get an actor who has some singing, who is a singer, but a musical singer. People always ask me, what's the difference between a musical and an opera? A musical is mic'd. That's probably the simplest way of differentiating the two. The training is quite different. Musical singers typically will not fill a 2,000-seat theater with their voice alone. It's mic'd. Mic'd way too high, typically, in my book.
Right.
And but a musical, if it is sung throughout, as Les Mis actually is pretty well, even the dialogue is sung. This is like a recitative. In that regard, it meets the criteria as an opera. Porgy and Bess is the best example, perhaps, because that was a musical and now is really considered an opera.
Uh-huh.
So the line is thin. In this particular one, this is, again, one of my favorite songs of this whole time period. It's the song Bring Him Home from Les Miserables, sung by Colm Wilkinson. Now, Colm Wilkinson, who was the original Jean Valjean in the piece, was an out-of-work actor in Ireland. I mean, I met him there, and he couldn't get a job. You know, you'd meet him in the pub, and he was having a hard time getting work. He had done some work in rock opera, and that was it. And then he got this role of Jean Valjean, the great hero of Victor Hugo's story. The musical is set in the times of political and social revolution in Paris in the 19th century, with music by Claude Michel Schoenberg. So another little anecdote about this that I know personally, because one of my friends was in the original cast, when they did the dress rehearsal and he sang this particular song, everything stopped. I mean, normally in a dress rehearsal, everyone's busy doing their thing and they're rushing about. Apparently, their breath was collectively taken away by the way Colm Wilkinson sings this aria about the young boy, bring him home from the barricades. Let's hear a little of that.
God on high, my prayer, in my need, you have always been there. Have known, if God had granted me a son, the sun must die one by one, how soon they fly all alone, and I am old and will be gone. Bring
Now, that may not be opera, but it's great music. It's Colm Wilkinson from the original cast of Les Miserables. So where should we go next? We have one more fun piece to play.
Well, I mean, we're talking because, I mean, today's program is devoted to the premiere opera Life is a Dream at the Santa Fe Opera, but we can't really play that much music from it. So we're sort of doing a little tour through other related themes, and one of them is this crazy sort of, I mean, I guess you would call it partly the American Idol phenomenon, mm-hmm, or Britain's Got Talent, where you've got people coming out of the woodwork. This guy, Paul Potts, who we're going to hear from in a moment. Probably at least a third of our listeners have seen this YouTube, mm-hmm, where this guy comes on to one of the British version of American Idol, and he kind of stumbles onto the stage, and he's got bad teeth and clearly low self-esteem, and he's kind of slumping. He's a middle-aged cell phone salesman, and people, the judges are kind of rolling their eyes and saying, oh my goodness, we're going to have to sit through 4 minutes of our lives being wasted by this guy. And then he opens his mouth.
And when he opens his mouth, this is what you hear.
Time to io li rivivrò. Quando sei lontano sogno all'orizzonte, manca le parole. E io sì lo so che sei con me, tu mia luna, tu sei qui con me. Mio sole, tu sei qui con me, con me, con me.
Who has since gone on to actually have a very successful touring career.
Yes, I know. Is that amazing? What a phenomenon.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, in my book,
fun.
Mary Charlotte, we all need to listen to music, and we have the choice of what sort of music we happen to want to listen to. And here's a good potpourri of different music we've presented today. I hope people enjoyed it.
Now, Life is a Dream, the opera which we started out talking about, is by composer Louis Spratlin, who's going to be giving a talk.
He is, yes. And this is thanks to Santa Fe New Music, who have a series called Living Composers Portraits. And Louis Spratlin will be talking on Friday, June 25th at 8 p.m. at the El Rey Theater in Albuquerque, and on Saturday, June 26th at 6 p.m. at Steeren Hall up at the Opera. And I'm sure that's on the Opera's website, santafeopera.org.
So one in Albuquerque and one in Santa Fe.
Right, and don't miss it. I mean, the chance to hear a composer talk about his new work before the premiere is really a one-off. It'll never happen again. It'll be very interesting, so hopefully people will show up for that.
Desiree Mays, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Desiree Mays is the author of Opera Unveiled and the nightly lecturer at the Opera's Preview Buffet. The Santa Fe Opera season opens this year on Friday, July 2nd. You can find them on the web at santafeopera.org, and their number is 505-986-5900. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Many thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.